Time unless the clerk corrects me. All right, if you'll announce counsel, please.
May I please support Mr. Ron Salmon, Mr. Arguably Appellant, Mr. Evan Wilkinson, Mr. Arguably Appellant.
All right, Mr. Salmon.
May I please support, would it be okay if I stay?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, we have 5 points of error here, and I'm going to direct most of my time, I think, to the first point of error. We feel like it's the most important. And it also kind of points 2, 3, 4, and 5 kind of fall in right behind the first point of error. This is a situation, a criminal case in which Mr. Beckstrand was charged, and what happened here was Mr. Beckstrand had a very bad splitting up, a divorce, and there was an agreement between Mr. Beckstrand and his wife that he would have his children on this day. Mr. Beckstrand did have his children. He asked his sister-in-law, his wife's sister, she would watch the children for a while. When he went to pick up the children, his sister-in-law told him that they would not be returning the children to him, even though there was a court order stating that he was to have the children that day. Mr. Beckstrand called all of his family members to find out where his children were. He drove all over the Metroplex, I believe, to Denton and to Plano to try to locate his children. Whenever he called, no one would answer his phone calls. He just didn't know where they were, so he went back to his wife's house, which used to be his house, but through their divorce, the wife did now have possession of the house. He went back to the house. He banged on the door. He eventually saw a light on in the house. He went around to the back, broke a window to a door, let himself in to check on the welfare of his children. At that point, the wife had called her brother over. He showed up. There was a confrontation, and then Mr. Beckstrand, the police showed up, and Mr. Beckstrand was charged with burglary. The first point of error is that throughout all of this, when it came to trial, Mr. Beckstrand, through his attorney, raised the defense of necessity, and the trial court denied that. He also raised the defense of self-defense, and the trial court also denied that. It's important because whenever they raised this defense, the defense counsel only had to show by a scintilla of evidence to support a self-defense claim. It was very clear that when the Mrs. Beckstrand's brother came over and confronted him, Mr. Beckstrand told him, first, you don't want any of this, meaning that he was not the first aggressor. He really kind of detached himself from any type of confrontation, and the brother still moved in, grabbed him by the arm, and threw him against a car. At that point, Mr. Beckstrand did defend himself, and that's where the altercation occurred. As far as the necessity defense, it's pretty clear that, let me back up and just say when analyzing a necessity defense, there's three things that have to be present. The actor has to reasonably believe that his actions are justified. There is a threat of harm. There has to be an urgency, and that his conduct will be justified. I think it's pretty reasonable for anyone to think that if you're supposed to have custody of the children, if you're going to have a bad divorce and the wife, or someone within her family tells you that they're not going to return the children, and certainly for 12 hours, and then on top of that, no one is answering a phone, no one is getting in touch with them, I think anyone would believe that their children might be in some type of harm. And through testimony, Mr. Beckstrand even stated he didn't know if his children were being drowned in some bathtub or if they were on their way to Brazil. He just didn't know what was going on, but he knew something was wrong. And I think that anyone in that situation would do anything that they could to try to locate their children. And it's not like Mr. Beckstrand went over to his wife's house and just created all this mayhem. I mean,
after 12 hours, this isn't like just a five-minute phone call and then he went looking for his kids. I think anyone would think after 12 hours not hearing where your children could be would create some sort of urgency. And then the justification for his conduct, I mean, he went to the back of the house. He let himself in, even though it is conceded that that was no longer his house through this divorce, but I think anyone would think that he'd be justified in trying to locate his kids, trying to locate anyone who might be in that house who could help him find his children.
Counsel, can I interrupt for a second, ask a question about what the record shows with regard to their being divorced, or the divorce was not final, or it was she was given it to use pursuant to the divorce. What does the record show about the status of the finality of the divorce, and specifically with regard to ownership of the house at that point, at the time of the occurrence? An order from the divorce court.
Yes. Yes,
Your Honor. Okay.
And so that would be our first argument to point one, that the trial court did err in not allowing a self-defense or a necessity whenever there was evidence presented on the necessity portion and also on the self-defense. In the second point of error, whenever there was an email that Mr. Beckstrand had sent to his wife, that was highly prejudicial, and it was more inflammatory in nature. And the probative value, the prejudicial effect of it outweighed the probative value in that Mrs. Beckstrand was there. She did testify. Everything that the state needed to elicit from that email, they were able to do through her testimony. So there would be no other reason to allow this email in other than just to inflame the jury. And it was our argument that the court did abuse its discretion by allowing that email. And point three is very similar to point two. It was just that the state wanted to get into Mr. Baxter's prior criminal history. However, his criminal history, including evading arrest and interfering with public duties, which really was not relevant to any issues in this case. Mr. Beckstrand had stated in the trial that this was something that is not normally in his character to do. And it was really more of an email at a time when he was upset, and he was emailing his wife about the whole situation. And so while I know the state's argument is going to be that he opened the door, even if he opened the door, the evading arrest and the interfering with public duties really had nothing to do with any type of violence or anything, which I would assume that that's what their point is going to be. Finally, point four and point five are statements made by a probation officer, and they were hearsay statements. The court or defense counsel did object to those statements, and the court still allowed them in. And it is, well, first on point four is that they violated the Confrontation Clause, since that person who made those statements was not made available for cross-examination. And it was an abuse of the discretion because they allowed that in this little hearsay. And the defense counsel, like I said, they did object. And we do have a case, Everett v. State, and it just states that all that a party has to do to avoid the forfeiture of a complaint on appeal is to let the trial judge know what it is that he was objecting and why he thinks he is entitled to it. And defense counsel, in this case, in the trial, did do that.
But I thought his objection was limited to just hearsay, as opposed to hearsay and a confrontation clause objection.
That is correct, Your Honor. And, but I, believe that he made it clear that it was hearsay and also that the probation officer would be available and that they just chose not to, to call her. So that's how we would wrap it up into the confrontation clause as well.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Salvant. Mr. Wilkinson.
May it please the court. I believe the state has adequately responded to the points that the appellant has raised in points of error 2 through 5. I'm not going to belabor the point unless the court has any specific questions. I'm not going to touch on those issues today. In short, the state believes that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in admitting any of the evidence under either Rule 402 or 403. And if it did, in the alternative, the state argues that none of that evidence, either alone or taken together, caused reversible error, was harmless to the point that it requires a new trial. I will address partially point of error number one. I'm not going to touch on the necessity defense. Again, this, I believe the state has adequately briefed that particular issue, unless the court has any specific questions. I do want to address the self-defense issue, however, because I'm afraid in reading my brief last night, I've done a very poor job of articulating the state's argument, largely because I believe that I misunderstood the defense argument. The state has taken the position that he wasn't entitled to the defense of self-defense because there was no affirmative evidence that that Morgan, the brother-in-law, soon to be ex-brother-in-law, was acting unlawfully when he approached and or assaulted the appellant. Reading over the briefs last night, I realized that the defense has implicitly, I'm not trying to put words in his mouth, but has implicitly conceded that there is no affirmative evidence of that. Instead, what his argument is, the status of the argument is a little more subtle than that. What he seems to be arguing is that he had a reasonable belief that Morgan was acting unlawfully, and he bases that reasonable belief on the statement in State's Exhibit 24, the email that he sent to his ex-wife a month later, in which he says, I had no idea you were in the house. Now, granted, at trial he insisted he broke into the house because he thought it was occupied. And in fact, he thought his children were there. And furthermore, at trial, he denied the validity of that statement, I had no idea. He claimed that he made it up simply to reassure his wife because he didn't want her to think that he was purposely upsetting her or something like that. Nevertheless, on appeal, he maintains that that statement justifies his self-defense claim on the basis that since he didn't know that she was in the house, he therefore had a reasonable belief that she hadn't called Morgan over to the house to protect her or the property, and therefore Morgan was not acting in the protection of the property of a third person under 9.432A, which states that a actor is justified in protecting a third person's property if the actor reasonably believes that the third person has requested his protection in the land of the property. So he's saying, hey, I didn't know. I reasonably believe that he didn't have the permission of the third person, i.e. the ex-wife, had not requested the protection of the land, and therefore I reasonably believe that he wasn't acting to protect the property. Therefore, I reasonably believe that he was acting unlawfully. There are several problems with that. The first and foremost is the law still says that if you cannot use your own criminal conduct to justify a claim of self-defense. And here, in this case, defendant appellant at trial admitted that he committed criminal mischief. Volume 4, page 127, specifically said, I committed a crime. Moreover, the evidence is replete that he was well, that he signed the agreed settlement, that he was aware that the house, actually, as of July 15th, that the house belonged to his ex-wife. He didn't have a key to the house. He actually had to break in. So the evidence is pretty overwhelming that he was aware that he had committed a crime at the time, although he denied it at trial. He said, I had a belief that I had, because my name was on the mortgage, I had a belief that I could break into the house. Furthermore, the evidence is overwhelming that the ex-wife actually did call her brother Morgan, and that he did respond because of her call, and that he entered the garage and approached appellant on the specific basis that his wife had called over and asked him to protect her and her property. But even if you put that aside, his argument fails, because Section 2A, which is the one I quoted of 9.43, isn't the only justification for the protection of third person's property. Under 9.43.1, you're justified in protecting a third person's property if the actor reasonably believes the unlawful interference constitutes attempted or consummated theft of or criminal mischief to the tangible movable property that the person is trying to protect. And in this instance, the state would maintain that defendant, as a matter of law, could not have reasonably believed that that Morgan wasn't acting unlawfully on the basis that he didn't reasonably believe that that appellant was attempting or consummating theft or criminal mischief, since he had already committed criminal mischief. He admitted that he broke the window and entered the house. So the state maintains he cannot avail himself. Yes, it's a very convoluted, subtle argument. The state maintains that he cannot avail himself of that second one, because as a matter of, he'd already committed criminal mischief. So that he can't claim that Morgan was unreasonable in believing that he was going to commit criminal mischief.
But does it make any difference that Morgan's the brother-in-law as opposed to being the wife who he's charged with knowledge of knowing has the right to possess the home?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but are you asking, does it make any difference whether it's Morgan and not the homeowner itself?
Yes.
Well, that's where 9.43 kicks in, okay, as opposed to 9.42,
okay,
the protection of a third person's property versus protection of your own property. And that's why essentially he's relying on Section 2 of 9.43. by saying, well, you didn't have her request, therefore it was illegal. Now, the evidence, as I say, is overwhelming that he did, so it wasn't illegal. As a matter of fact, he was acting legally in using force in attempting to restrain appellant. But what he's arguing is, in the self-defense statute, I reasonably believed it was unlawful because I reasonably believed my ex-wife hadn't called him. How reasonable that is debatable. But since this is a submission on a self-defense charge as opposed to some sort of sufficiency argument, we don't get into it unless it's so outrageously unreasonable that, you know, no prudent person could. I think this fast approaches that line, by the way. You know, there are some where, even though there may be some evidence, the defendant testifies to some sort of fact, it's just so unreasonable under the circumstances that it doesn't even warrant a submission. An example in this case, in fact, would be, well, I broke into the house because I believed aliens were kidnapping my children. That's not going to get him a self-defense charge, regardless of whether there's some evidence there, because some prudent, reasonable person would believe that. A more realistic one, which still wouldn't merit a self-defense charge, I'm sorry, a necessity charge, would be something along the lines of, I thought Al-Qaeda had kidnapped my children as part of an elaborate terrorist plot. Once again, it is so unreasonable, it is so irrational, that it wouldn't warrant the submission of a necessity charge. The state would suggest that in this instance, that same thing would apply here to the self-defense on the third person, that it would be so irrational for him to believe that the brother just happened to be there, just happened to come by, and just happened to call the police, and then just happened to approach him and tell him, you got to leave, the police are on the way, that it's basically unreasonable or irrational as a matter of law and doesn't warrant the submission of the self-defense charge.
Isn't
Isn't there also case law that
I beg your pardon. That's a third alternative argument.
Isn't there also case law that says that a defendant can't create the circumstance under which they then claim self-defense?
I'm getting to be an old man. I'm having trouble hearing. I beg your pardon.
That the defendant can't create the circumstance under which they then claim self-defense.
Precisely, Your Honor, and that was our initial argument. That having committed the offense of, at the very least, trespass, he cannot then use that trespass to justify his own acts of self-defense. And we've cited a number of cases in which that's the case: the robbery, burglary. There's a trespass case, so there's a very old one, and a number of other instances where a defendant has tried to claim his own criminal conduct as some sort of justification for self-defense, and the courts have consistently rejected that, and obviously public policy grounds, but as well there are issues of reasonable and rational that kick in at that point. The Court of Criminal Appeals has consistently said a defense or a lesser included offense has to be a rational alternative to the criminal conduct charge, and we would argue in this instance that's not a rational alternative to the criminal conduct that as charged, a burglary with intent to commit or did commit assault. So unless the court has any questions, the state prays for an affirmance.
All right, thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. Mr. Salvant, rebuttal?
Yes, if there is a necessity, then the conduct is no longer criminal. And what we mean by that is if he, like I said before, he reasonably believes something was wrong and that there was a valid necessity for it, then that conduct is no longer a criminal conduct. And it would be akin to if I'm with my father and he starts to tell me that he chest pains, and I rush into the hospital, and the police get behind me and turn on their lights, and I continue to go on, and I get to the hospital and drop them off, and they say, well, why didn't you stop? And I said, well, I believe my father's having a heart attack, and we find out that it's only heartburn. I still reasonably believe, and I had ideas, a reasonable idea, that there was something more to it, just because I could not completely articulate what his medical condition would have been.
The hypothetical that you just gave has the elements of imminent harm and that the conduct is immediately necessary. That's in your hypothetical for sure. But what was the evidence of an imminent harm that a reasonable person would believe necessitated immediate action on his part to break into the house?
Physical harm or them being taken to a different jurisdiction or out of the country. I mean, I don't know how anyone could believe that that would not be an urgent situation. And as far as the protection of the property and the state stated that the defense of third person, defense of property, well, when Morgan came into contact with Mr. Beckstrom, he wasn't trying to steal anything. He wasn't taking anything. There were no other people in the area. So I don't think that their argument of defense of third person or defense of property really stands. I mean, the criminal conduct, just like the state stated, Morgan comes in there and tells him, hey, you have to leave. You have to leave. The police are coming. Well, that's fine, but Morgan took it one step further. And he put his hands on my client. And at that point, the criminal conduct was assault by contact by Morgan. Whether he had the right to be there or not, I mean, I think that his legal rights ended once he made it a physical confrontation as opposed to just telling him, hey, you have to leave, especially if he wasn't provoked. As a matter of fact, my client even told him, hey, you don't want any of this, you know, step back. And Morgan then took the next step of putting his hands on him. And there was evidence of that. And by the court not allowing the necessity or the self-defense argument to be placed in the jury charge, that was harmful error. I mean, the jury never had a chance to even consider that. And I think it's pretty clear that the law is that if there is any type of evidence of necessity or self-defense, no matter how small it may be, that's still going to be something for the jury to decide. And there was. We may not think that it was the best evidence or the strongest evidence, but the law is that if there is a ton of evidence, then that needs to be presented to the jury, and it just was. And that is where the harm comes in. They never had a chance to even consider that.
Were there temporary orders in effect in the family court regarding where he was supposed to pick up the children?
And let me ask, that raised another question. This sister-in-law is the wife of Morgan, correct? The one, is that the one that had the children that day?
I can't remember if it was the...
Yes.
No, she's not. It was a separate sister who lived with another sister in Denton.
Okay. All right. We'll look at that in the record. Okay, thank you. All right, gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments today and your briefing for this case. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. That concludes our arguments for this morning, so the court will now be adjourned.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas.